It is Tuesday, September 18th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Victor Beatty, coming to you from Washington. Coming up, Russia, Turkey say they have found a way to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe in Syria. The two Korean leaders meet in a summit in Pyongyang,
which, of course, is about a peace declaration, a nuclear inventory by Kim, issuing a list of nuclear weapons, which is unlikely. That is a genuine admission of what North Korea has.
Also ahead, a ratcheting up of trade tensions with China. It's all on today's International Edition. We begin in the Middle East, where a pro-government assault in Syria's northwest appears to have been put off, at least for now. Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Turkish counterpart Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Russian and Turkish troops will enforce a new demilitarized zone in the last major rebel enclave in Syria, Idlib province, which borders Turkey. A pro-government assault had been threatened for weeks, creating what many feared would be among the worst humanitarian crises in that long seven-year conflict. An estimated 3 million people, many displaced under previous evacuation deals from other parts of Syria, are in the province. Under the agreement, a contact line is to be created by October 15 between the armed opposition and government forces, with the withdrawal of what are called radically minded rebels. Mr. Erdogan insisted by October 10, heavy weapons, rockets, tanks, and mortars in the possession of opposition groups will be withdrawn. I spoke with Alam Payen, director of the Middle East Studies Center at The Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio, about this new effort at avoiding this humanitarian catastrophe.
This is the third meeting between Russia and Turkey. Once it was between Russia, Turkey, and Iran in the capital of Kazakhstan, which was Astana. Then there was a meeting between the president of Iran, Rouhani, and Putin and Erdogan in Tehran. It did not get to any kind of results. So this one was in Sochi, the Black Sea port. So apparently both Turkey and Russia have decided that there should be no assault on Idlib because the United Nations, the United States, and many other Europeans and Muslim countries have protested that would be a humanitarian disaster because in Idlib there are not only some terrorist groups like al-Nusra and others active, but almost 3 million civilians are living there. So that would be really and this is one reason why Turkey was against that, this assault from the beginning. And Iran and Russia, which is supporting the Bashar al-Assad government, and they were keen to probably make this attack and then finally remove the terrorists from that area. But finally, they've learned that it's not that easy. There will be a large number of the civilian casualties. So probably they have come to their senses, and now they have decided so there will be about 15 to 20 kilometers away from the city, so that will be a demilitarized zone. And that demilitarized zone will be probably somehow protected by Turkish and by Russian forces. There is one thing that we did not see in the news, that Iran is not, anyhow, there is nothing about Iran, that what the Iranian supporting forces will be doing. And so they've totally almost either marginalized Iran here, or it was probably deliberate in the part of Turkey and Syria that Iran is not party to this, somehow to keep Israel quiet and Americans quiet. So maybe that was the reason that they're not mentioning much about Iran.
Neither Russian President Putin nor Turkey's leader Erdogan explained how they plan to differentiate quote-unquote radically minded rebels from other anti-Assad groups in Idlib.
Yes, so the problem is that in Idlib, and as in many other cities, so it is not only that radical groups such as ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Al-Nusra, there are civilians and there are many other former military officers who are against the Bashar al-Assad regime. So there are opposition. There is a Free Syrian Army. There are some Kurdish groups that who are also opposing the Bashar al-Assad government. So it's not only that the terrorists are in control of Idlib. There are many other groups who are opposing the Bashar al-Assad government. And so for that reason, they are thinking that it will be very hand-to-hand combat if they will go in. And that would probably result in a very large number of civilian casualties. Well, by the way, we have to keep things in perspective. Of almost a 24 or 25 million Syrian, estimated Syrian population, 5 million of them have become refugees outside Syria. And 6 million are internally displaced. and about 500,000 Syrians have been killed since 2011. It's a very large number of casualties, one can say. So probably it's almost reaching what Afghans were at one point when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. So Afghanistan has this kind of large number of internally displaced and refugees. So Syria has almost reaching that point. So it is a humanitarian disaster already. It does not look good for the Syrians. It does not look good for the Iranians or Russians. Turkey is not the country which is bombarding the civilians and other groups. It is the Russian and Iranians and the Bashar al-Assad government which are using barrel bombs and chemical agents and all sorts of weapons against the opposition.
Well, as you know, previous de-escalation deals have not lasted very long. But will Idlib remain outside of Syria, or will it eventually be brought into the Syrian fold?
No, that's what Syria is counting on time. So what happened? When the Arab Spring started in almost 2010, December of 2010, the Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, was overthrown. The Tunisian president was overthrown. The Yemeni president was overthrown. And the only country that which remained, and it's Bashar al-Assad, and he just toughened the situation, and then he's surviving all those what so-called the Arab Spring. So many others have gone. He's the only one that we, and he's surviving because Russia is helping Bashar al-Assad, and Iranians are helping. So if there would not have been these two countries supporting Bashar al-Assad, he would have gone, and probably faced the same kind of end as others did.
Alam Payen directs the Middle East Studies Center at Ohio State University. Meanwhile, Syria said its air defenses intercepted missiles fired from the sea at the coastal city of Latakia. The Sana'a News Agency said the Technical Industry Institute was the apparent target. It said a handful of people were wounded, but did not disclose who fired the missiles.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London!
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA, or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on the Voice of America.
Among the top stories making our VOA website, President Trump slaps new sanctions on Chinese products, U.S. to cut cap on refugees to 30,000 for 2019, U.S. blames Russia for cheating on North Korea sanctions, South Korean leader begins third Korea's summit in Pyongyang, and ex-Congolese warlord Jean-Pierre Bemba sentence upheld. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un welcomed South Korea's President Moon Jae-in at Pyongyang Airport Tuesday at the start of their third inter-Korean summit this year, expected to focus on peace, easing tensions, and denuclearization. Their summit expected to extend 3 days to Thursday. I spoke with Sung-Yoon Lee, Associate Professor of Korean Studies at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, about the prospect for progress on any of these objectives.
The third meeting is never as exciting as the initial meeting. The luster of the first summit meeting between the two leaders back in April, that's gone. It is the first visit to North Korea by a South Korean president in 11 years. So what can we extrapolate from the agenda, which, of course, is about a peace declaration, a nuclear inventory by Kim, issuing a list of nuclear weapons, which is unlikely. That is a genuine admission of what North Korea has, is not going to happen. We could see a fake list, however. What does this achieve? Well, it achieves quite a lot for North Korea. because North Korea will be able to further advance its image as a normal country, a normal global statesman presiding over a not-so-abnormal dictatorship, and North Korea will further gain the momentum, keep the momentum of engaging the United States and further trapping the Trump administration into mind-boggling, never-ending negotiation process without reaching a resolution. What's in it for the South Korean visitor, President Moon? Well, if you declare an end of the Korean War between North Korea and South Korea, that sounds like genuine peace is near. But when you're talking about peace, what are we really talking about? How many wars have there been in the Korean Peninsula since the end of the Korean War in 1953? Zero. None. A shaky peace it's been, but there has been no war. There has been de facto peace. So why is there such an insistence on the part of South Korea to declare the end of the war and conclude a peace treaty and so on? Because that would further advance South Korea's interest in re-engaging North Korea financially, that is, subsidizing the Kim regime under the illusion of peace and reconciliation. And this is all good politics in terms of domestic politics in South Korea. And this is simply because the South Korean public supports it. It does not have the stomach to escalate tension with North Korea whenever there is the illusion of denuclearization and de-escalation and peace and all these good things. The South Korean public will support that. So I think the two Korean states, we see a convergence of interests between the two Korean states, and I think the Trump administration will find itself in a tight position. It will be very difficult for Trump to declare, to admit that he was duped by the North Korean dictator in Singapore. Rather, to the contrary, Trump will want to have a follow-up summit meeting with Kim Jong-un, and all this favors Kim Jong-un.
Mr. Moon, accompanied by corporate executives, including the head of Samsung Electronics, J.Y. Lee, and chiefs of SK Group, LG Group. What is the best that we can hope for out of this summit?
Well, clearly South Korea is sending a message to the world that South Korea is not shy about making investments, major investments in North Korea, returning to the same kind of unconditional subsidization of the Kim regime as we saw under President Roh Moo-hyun, President Moon's former boss, who was the president between 2003 and 2008, when the South Korean government gave North Korea, no questions asked, an average of $900 million a year for 5 years, most of it in cash. So I think sanctions enforcement is that in name only. There is no real political will to enforce sanctions, certainly not on the part of China or Russia or South Korea. And sending this kind of message that engaging North Korea and giving generously to North Korea will guarantee peace, eliminate the possibility, the danger of war, and so forth, again, is good business. It's very short-sighted, that kind of thinking on the part of Seoul, South Korea. But in the short term, there are pragmatic benefits, political benefits to this kind of unconventional approach to engaging North Korea.
Mr. Moon, under a lot of pressure politically, his approval rating has slipped. There seems to be growing skepticism in South Korea that anything will come out of this.
Well, I mean, there'll be lots of embraces, handshakes, smiles, bonhomie. So there will be the illusion in terms of the atmospherics. There'll be, you know, warmth and reconciliation and a lot of Korean solidarity and so forth expressed. And again, that creates the illusion of diplomatic progress. But on the real issues, substantive issues like North Korea's denuclearization and reform and opening, of course, not only will there be no progress in the near term, the effect will be quite to the contrary. Kim Jong-un will have a free pass to further develop his growing lethal capabilities with which to return to threatening South Korea and the region and the United States at a date of his own choice.
You mentioned sanctions. There was quite an acrimonious debate at the UN over sanctions enforcement between the U.S. and Russia. What do you make of that?
Well, you know what President Trump did in impulsively agreeing to meet with Kim Jong-un and actually meeting him back in June? That really sort of was self-deterrence. It was preemption, self-preemption. That is, it really took out any kind of teeth in sanctions enforcement by the U.S., and states like Russia and China and even South Korea will no longer feel obliged to enforce sanctions or even pretend to. So, yes, it shows the increasing wariness on the part of the Trump administration that North Korea now has a free pass to completely do what it pleases in concert with China and Russia and South Korea. So it shows you anxiety on the part of the administration, but no UN member state, especially big countries like Russia, will respect any kind of summons by the UN Security Council or the United States to go back to enforcing tough sanctions against North Korea.
Sungyoon Lee is an associate professor in Korean studies at Tufts University. Wednesday, the two Korean leaders are to deliver a joint statement and a separate military pact aimed at diffusing tensions and preventing armed clashes.
Hello, this is James Butte, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA's International Edition. Israel says it's agreed to absorb 1,000 Ethiopian Jews among some 8,000 who want to emigrate to the Jewish state. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said special focus has been placed on those who already have children in the country. But a spokeswoman for what is called the Struggle for Ethiopian Aliyah called the announcement disappointing and a spit in the face of Israel's Ethiopian community. I spoke with University of South Carolina political science professor Joseph Olmert about the Israeli government decision.
There are in Israel over 125,000 Ethiopian Jews. The group that is still stationed in Addis Ababa belongs to a group called the Falashmura, which are people that converted to Christianity because of atrocities and harassment of Jews in the old days, and many of them haven't yet converted back to Judaism. And there is a problem in terms of the law of return in Israel, and even among the Ethiopian community leaders in Israel, there are those who say to the government, hang on, you know, these people converted to Christianity while we Jews maintain our religion, so it's not exactly the same situation. So if you have about 120,000 Jews from Ethiopia already in Israel, a few more thousands are still waiting, how can it be called a spit in the face of the Ethiopian Jewish community? Those activists sometimes, you know, tend to exaggerate their messages in order to win attraction and support abroad, and they don't realize that by so doing, they are causing damage to the overall cause of immigration from Ethiopia. So, I mean, let's put it all in proper context.
There have been some Ethiopian Jews who staged a series of protests in recent years denouncing what they call racism, discrimination against them in Israel, demanding family members be allowed to join them. What are these protests?
Obviously, there have been pockets of racism in the attitude towards people like this, and while it is totally reprehensible and never to be accepted, it can also be understood, you know, because that's what happens in a situation like that. And I say it, you know, wholeheartedly with condemnation of that, but one can see that there are pockets of racism, and whenever it happens, it should be dealt with severely, and it has been dealt with severely. The protests were organized by a group among the Ethiopian Jews who live in Israel. That's exactly the right to do so when they feel that they have a problem. That's a democracy. I would like you to know, for example, that the chairman of the Israeli Knesset dealing with immigration to Israel is an Ethiopian Jew himself, you know, is a member of the Likud party. So, you know, we have to put all this in a proper context. There may be some protests by some groups, but the overall majority of the Ethiopian Jews are not participating in this protest. And I think that altogether, with all the difficulties and all the issues that have been aroused, including pockets of racism, their absorption in Israel is nothing short of a miracle, because you talk here about the integration of people from a completely different cultural background, and after 30 years you already have judges of Ethiopian origin, high officers in the military, academics, politicians, sports people, you know, they are part and parcel, integrated part of Israeli society.
Joseph Olmert is a political science professor at the University of South Carolina. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
As expected, President Donald Trump Monday imposed 10% tariffs on another $200 billion worth of Chinese imports over China's economic and trade policies, including intellectual property theft. The president spoke about trade with China before his announcement as he addressed the National Council for the American Worker.
I have great respect for President Xi, as you know. I was over there for 2 days with him. I have a lot of respect for China, but last year, we lost $375 billion in deficits, and we had, in my opinion, way over $500 billion in cash. And that's not including certain items that we won't even talk about. So when I lose that, we can't do that. We can't do that anymore. It should have been done many years ago. It should have been done by other presidents. And actually, it's a disgrace that it wasn't done. So China is now paying us billions of dollars in tariffs, and hopefully we'll be able to work something out. We'll be having an announcement tonight after close of market, and that will take place, a pretty comprehensive statement. Kevin may speak, and Larry Kudlow may speak a little bit at that time. But some very positive news. I think it's going to work out very well with China. I think they want to make a deal. They do want to make a deal. That I can tell you, they want to make a deal. But from our standpoint, it has to be fair. It has to take care of our workers. We can't have them pinpointing our farmers because they think that weakens me a little bit, because our farmers are the great. They are incredible patriots. They understand what's happening. The markets were closed to them. Vast markets were closed to them. And the farmers have been hurting for 15 years. If you look at soybeans, pricing before the election, for 5 years it was cut in half. And so we're going to open up markets.
The collection of the latest tariffs are expected to begin September 24, with the rate increasing to 25% by year's end. The U.S. has already imposed duties on $50 billion in Chinese imports. Beijing has retaliated and threatens to do so again. There's been no progress in bilateral trade talks. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondence reports around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
And this is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has announced the number of refugees the Trump administration will allow into the country for fiscal 2019, which begins October 1st.
The United States anticipates processing up to 310,000 refugees and asylum seekers in fiscal year 2019. We propose resettling up to 30,000 refugees under the new refugee ceiling, as well as processing more than 280,000 asylum seekers. They will join the over 800,000 asylum seekers who are already inside the United States and who are awaiting adjudication of their claims. These expansive figures continue the United States' long-standing record as the most generous nation in the world when it comes to protection-based immigration and assistance. Since 2000, over 1.5 million people have been admitted as refugees or granted asylum in the United States of America. Since 2001, the U.S. has permanently admitted 4.1 million total lawful permanent residents from refugee-producing nations.
Pompeo said national security concerns and the need to restore what he called the integrity of the overwhelmed asylum system drove the decision. He noted recent programs allowed a member of Islamic State and others with criminal records into the country. The fiscal 2018 ceiling for refugees was put at 45,000, the lowest since 1980. Finally, Elon Musk's SpaceX late Monday announced that Japanese billionaire Yusaku Maezawa, founder and CEO of online fashion retailer Zozo, will be the first private passenger to circle the moon in a flight scheduled in 2023. He'll be the first person to travel to the moon since the last U.S. Apollo mission in 1972. Maezawa said he'd like to invite 6 to 8 artists to join him aboard the Big Falcon rocket. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Johnny Ellison. I'm Victor Beatty in Washington. Thank you for listening.
This is Today in History. On September 18th, 1180, Philip II Augustus became King of France. He is considered one of the most successful and popular rulers of his time and is the first French monarch to be called the King of France rather than the King of the Franks. In 1851, the first edition of the New York Daily Times was published. It's now known as the New York Times, one of America's premier newspapers. On this day in 1945, at the conclusion of World War II, U.S. General Douglas MacArthur moved his command headquarters to Tokyo. The Supreme Allied Commander in the South Pacific would lay the groundwork for Japan's rebirth as an economic powerhouse. In 1947, the National Security Act, which unified the nation's Army, Navy, and Air Force, went into effect. On September 18, 1961, United Nations Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld died when his plane crashed near Ndola in what is now Zambia. Hammarskjöld was on his way to negotiate an end to a crisis then taking place in Congo. He was posthumously awarded the 1961 Nobel Peace Prize. On this day in 1970, rock legend Jimi Hendrix died at the age of 28 following an apparent drug overdose. In 2007, Buddhist monks joined anti-government protesters in Burma, starting what some are calling the Saffron Revolution. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.